This show features adults using adult language. You've been warned.
I mean, if it is genre defining, then there's only one right answer, and it's mine.
Hammercast is a weekly news and discussion show about the world of games, smashing buttons, clicking mice, shuffling cards, and rolling dice. This is episode 9 of Hammercast, recorded Thursday, April 2nd, 2015. Joining me this week, as always, are your hosts, Joe Hollis and Todd Chartier. I'm Dwayne Sibley, and Hammercast is made possible by the Hammer Gaming Community, an adults-only group of gamers from across North America and Europe that play all sorts of games together. Games on screens, games on tables, games like Elite Dangerous, Cards Against Humanity, Dragon Age Inquisition, and Castle Panic. You can check them out at hammergaming.com. So, good afternoon, boys. How are we doing this week?
Doing good.
Doing pretty good.
So, what have you guys been playing lately?
We're finishing, what's it called? Borderlands 2. We're on the last chapter, pretty sure, anyways.
Yeah. You've been away, so we haven't finished it up quite yet, but we're going to do that pretty soon.
Sweet.
Yeah, me traveling all over Hell and Creation.
I expect to see two green squares on my friends list this weekend on Steam, at least before you have to leave again, Todd.
I think it's only going to take probably a couple hours tops to finish it at this point.
Awesome.
Yeah, I think we're pretty close. I mean, we didn't just start the last chapter. I think we're actually into it a tiny bit. And I do fly out again on Monday. I'm gone for the week, all next week, so you'll have a guest.
Yes, we will.
So hopefully we'll get that wrapped up this week.
Yep, we'll
pick something else.
Yeah, we had to stop midway through the final chapter because the levels kind of got above our heads. So
had to go back and do a little more side questing.
Yeah,
and some of those are pretty tough too. Now, just as a note here, we have not done any of the DLC, so I don't know if we're going to or not, or if we're just gonna move on to another game. We'll see.
I've heard most of it is worth it. And if you're only going to choose one to do, the word is that you have to do the Tiny Tina expansion because it's completely based around D&D.
She's funny as shit.
Yeah, she is funny as hell. I love her. But let me see. What have I been playing lately? I have been playing Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate for the Nintendo 3DS. My son and I recently got a couple of the new 3DS XLs when they were finally able to get off the boat from Japan. And we picked up Monster Hunter because we were looking for a game that the two of us could play together in a more meaningful way than Pokemon. Because in Pokemon, you can either duel or you can trade, which is fun, but it gets awfully repetitive after a while. We picked up Monster Hunter, and neither of us had ever really played a Monster Hunter game before, and it has a ridiculously steep learning curve, but if you can push yourself through it, it is incredibly rewarding. It is so much fun to go out there and hunt down whatever the heck we can find and get all sorts of cool materials and bring them back to camp and turn them into weapons and armor that we can use to hunt down even bigger monsters. And it's a bit of a treadmill, but it's a damned fun treadmill.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. I mean, what I can't really wrap my head around what kind of game it is. Like, walk me through a play session.
Okay, so you start it up and you're in your base camp with the rest of your caravan, and there are numerous merchants there. There's a blacksmith who can help you craft, and a quest hub that you can go to find the latest hunts. And you choose a hunt. It has a fee that you pay to start the hunt, and it has promised rewards at the end, just like a quest in an RPG. And when you go out and leave the base camp, you're going out into a set map. Like there'll be a mountain biome, there'll be a plains biome, there will be a forest, etc. And you'll go out there, and in every area of this map there are numerous things. There's enemies are animals for you to fight. Sometimes some of them are herbivores and will ignore you. Some of them are carnivores and will attack you. There's resource nodes everywhere, so you can go mining, you can go bug catching, you can pick flowers or mushrooms or what have you. And every one of these things that you pick up has a use in game. Usually the hunts will have you either go harvest a certain number of things or go kill a certain number of a certain type of monster, or in the rare case, go kill one very large major monster that, you know, you have to kind of stock up resources to go out and go do. And when you're done with your mission, you bring everything you got back to camp and you collect your reward. And you use all of the resources you gathered from picking flowers and skinning monsters and, you know, mining ore to turn it into bigger, better armor and equipment for you so that you can take on bigger hunts and get bigger rewards. And it's also got online multiplayer, which is the big thing that my son and I have been using, because we'll go ahead and team up and take on the big monsters that either of us can't really take on by ourselves.
Interesting. Is it online, like the other person can be anywhere?
Well, the other person, it's kind of lobby based. You open up a lobby and then other people will join it. And then once you've decided on the quest, the other people pick it up and up to four of you head out together and you're all on the same adventure map when you go out on the hunt.
But it's not like local Wi-Fi. I mean, the other person's can be anywhere.
There is both a local Wi-Fi mode and an internet enabled mode. So I can either game with four hunters from around the world, or I can, you know, just keep it local and play with my kid.
Now, is that a fairly new concept on the DS? Because I've never really seen a DS game that had that kind of multiplayer.
There are a few DS games that have online multiplayer. It wasn't very prevalent back in the regular Nintendo DS days with the DS and the DSi. And so on. But ever since the 3DS became a thing, Nintendo's been opening up slightly to more and more online multiplayer. I know Mario Kart 7 for the 3DS allows you to race against anonymous folk on the internet without having to do the onerous friend code exchange thing that you always had to do in the DS days. I mean, there still are friend codes, but they've been trying to make it so that it's a lot less onerous than it used to be.
Interesting. Well, see, there you go. You brought something new to the table.
And that's Monster Hunter 4 Ultimate?
Yep.
Ultimate.
It has a difficulty rating as unforgiving and rated the number one hardest 3DS role-playing game on GameFAQs.
Really?
Yeah. All right, I think I'll pass. I was actually looking at it. I'm going, oh, maybe. Never mind.
Well, I mean, it says that it's difficult by yourself, but if you're in a group, then it's not so bad.
Yeah, I was about to say, keep in mind, you've already got two friends you know with this game who would be glad to hop online with you and help you kill any monster you needed or help you farm any gear you needed.
Yeah, it's just another thing I don't have time for in my life. Not right now, anyways. Maybe after all my traveling finishes up.
Maybe someday.
Someday.
Well, we've got a little bit of follow-up this week. Let's see. Jeff Gretz, who was previously a guest here on the show, and you can find him at FeralGeek6 on Twitter, noted that Nintendo games for iOS means that his dream of Pokemon on his phone may finally come true. And he added the oh-so-wonderful hashtag Pokemon while I poop.
Yeah, I mean, that's totally a thing. I mean, I'm using that hashtag now.
Wow.
Line Freeze left us a couple of comments on Twitter. He says that we've now been waiting longer for Half-Life 3 than we did for Half-Life 2. It was 6 years between Half-Life 1's release and Half-Life 2's release, and we've now been waiting 8 years and counting to see if the Half-Life saga will be continued.
It won't.
Yeah, probably won't.
Yeah.
Also, he pointed out to us, since we were talking about Star Citizen last week, he pointed out that the ship turrets are not manable yet. Full multi-crew functionality will be coming in Star Citizen's 2.0 release.
Yeah, I heard in some ships you can actually get into the turret, but you can't actually shoot yet.
Todd, you've mentioned a few times on the show now, whenever we've talked about virtual reality, that sometimes the headsets tend to make you sick.
Yeah, it's. I think that's saying it really nicely. They make me want to projectile vomit blood and nails.
Ooh, like a, like a really gory shotgun. That's terrible.
Like, you know, it's one thing to want to vomit, but at the same time, you're dizzy and your whole inner ear is all kind of messed up and your brain is just totally.
So there's just some serious, vertigo going on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's almost like full on complete motion sickness when you're out on a boat.
Oof. Well, there are some researchers at Purdue University who may have stumbled onto something that could help you with your vertigo issues in virtual reality. They've found that putting a virtual nose in the center of the player's field of view, where we are accustomed to seeing our nose, but also ignoring it, helps people who normally get sick in VR stay in there without feeling nauseous.
Yeah, you know, I read this article, and it what they described as what people feel when wearing a VR headset is very similar to what I get. So I'm interested to try this to see if it actually makes a difference. See if my brain is dumb enough to make this work.
Well, I heard the skin color. You could pick the skin color on it, and they mentioned having the idea of picking your own nose for the sim.
Totally.
So you get to pick your own nose for the for this proposed idea.
VR nose picking. We've come into our own.
We've come into something. I'm still not quite sure what. Crowfall finished their crowdfunding campaign with $1.76 million. So good for them.
Yep, 45 of it was mine, just saying.
It remains to be seen, though, whether just under $2 million is going to be enough to deliver an MMO of the caliber that they were talking about.
Well, we'll see. It's the first MMO that actually feels like it has a different concept to it than just the normal, you know, tank and spang treadmill. Yeah. So I'm curious to see how much they can pull off. I mean, 1.7 million, you know, like I said, my number's 800, right? I always say that anything under 800 and there's no way you could pull off a game. So, you know, they doubled that and that's enough money to make a game. It's just going to be interesting to see if it's the game they sold.
Not everyone can pull 77 million.
Right. Not everybody is Chris Roberts. Exactly. That dude must have spent a lot of time on his knees.
That dovetails very nicely into our next bit of follow-up about Star Citizen. There was an article from Polygon this week where they said that Star Citizen's secret is to never stop crowdfunding. Like Crowfall, Star Citizen started on Kickstarter, but once the Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign wrapped up, they never stopped accepting money. They very quickly moved on to accepting money via their own website, and they have continued to accept money from fans, from the user base or soon to be user base. And that is what has allowed them to raise astronomical numbers in their funding. So it'll be interesting to see if Crowfall actually keeps the doors open after they wrap up their Kickstarter, or if they just try to make do with the 1.7 million that they've got.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I think that, you know, this is, that whole project, Crowfall, you know, I read it and was like, oh, that's kind of neat. I'll give them some money in case it happens to get funded. I really didn't expect it to get funded. So I'm really curious to see how this all goes now. In every sense, whether or not they keep crowdfunding, whether or not they actually make a playable game, you know, everything.
How about you, Joe?
I mean, really, why would you stop accepting money? It sounds like a basic idea, but nobody really ever keeps asking for money after the Kickstarter has been finished, I suppose.
Some games really do, but, you know, I think it's not to cut you off, Joe. You know, I think the difference, I think there's a big difference with Star Citizen is that they're selling tangible goods in the game, you know, the ships. And I think that's a great way to raise money. Yeah. Now, some of these other games may not have the ability to do that. Now, you know, in essence, Star Citizen is selling pay to win. Because you can, hey, if you want to spend $15,000, you can get every ship in the game. Just saying, I'm not willing to drop 15 grand, but, you know, if there are people out there that are, then, you know, you've just got every ship.
Yep. And there are people out there who have done it.
Which is crazy.
Little bit.
I mean, part of the fun for me is, you know, I'll get a basic level ship and then craft or purchase in game the bigger stuff. Because then there's more of a sense of accomplishment when you earn it, as opposed to just shelling out a whole bunch of money and having everything in the game day one.
Right.
Yeah, I don't necessarily mind any of that. My whole draw to that game is the multi-person ships. So I think it would be totally badass to get a couple people together, you know, gunners, a pilot, navigator, I don't know, whatever the positions happen to be.
You want the Death Star escape scene from Star Wars. You want a pilot and you want people in gunner seats and you want a big-ass Wookiee in there with a bowcaster roaring at things and a really annoying gold robot. And you want it all to happen in your ship in Star Citizen. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I would spend $250 for that experience if it meant that was what I had to spend to buy that ship.
Wow.
And when you think about it, when you have the better ships, you can turn the game more into exploration because the universe is going to be huge. So there's a lot to see. And maybe the game will be good for people who just want to be explorers. Because I heard there's some sort of aspect where when you discover new areas, then you get to contribute in naming of new systems and stuff.
Yeah, I think the problem with that is people will have that all settled out in the first couple of weeks. But they're only talking about 100 systems.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, that was the last stretch goal that they talked about was 100 systems.
Well, I thought they were going to expand it as you play, but I couldn't.
No, they definitely plan to. They have not said anything about at what rate or anything like that. But one of the stretch goals was hiring a team of people that do nothing but build procedural stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
To, you know, automatically or whatever, generate new systems and worlds and all this kind of stuff.
Still a mystery what we're going to end up seeing.
I look forward to finding out, though.
Yeah.
I read a Wired article this week with a really funny headline. Fans have dropped $77 million on this guy's buggy half-built game. And it was about Star Citizen. But they did an interesting feature on this guy named Wolf Knight. He's a IT professional who has to date dropped over $22,000 into Star Citizen.
Wow.
Damn.
He's pretty much bought everything, including the $10,000 Wing Commander package. So he's got 44 ships and access to the in-game VIP spaceship lounge called the Million Mile High Club. He also was entitled to a number of other perks, including spending a day with Chris Roberts, which amazingly enough, he declined because, in his words, Roberts has better things to do, like finish the game.
Well, I mean, that has some value. I give the guy some credit on that. I think we'd all like to see that.
So why don't we go straight into our stories of the week? Joe, I think you're up to lead off. So what's your story of the week?
My story of the week is a unique idea that started about 8 months ago or so. It's a game called Nevermind, which utilizes biofeedback enhanced horror. Basically, it monitors your pulse or your heart rate or your facial expressions, depending on which of the sensors you're using, and changes the game based on how you're reacting to it. The more your heart rate picks up, the more the jump scares kind of pick up, and basically, instead of as your stress levels go up, you hope that the game calms down a little. It has the opposite effect, whereas the game gets harder, more scary stuff starts to pop up, your screen will start fuzzing, you'll start seeing walls turn to blood, stuff kind of on those lines.
Oh, wow. Wait, walls turning to blood?
That doesn't happen in your house?
No, not lately.
Well, I mean, I saw in the trailer there was one scene where he walks into a room and the wall kind of flashes, and then there's a big blood stain down the side of the wall. That's what I mean by the walls turning to blood. And I saw somebody play this a very long time ago, so it wasn't up to date. The trailer that they recently released looks a lot more polished, so what he played a long time ago isn't necessarily what you would get if you played it today. I haven't seen anybody play it recently. I don't own the game myself, but it looks like an interesting idea. And yeah, that's a horrifying picture that Dwayne just put up.
I will make sure to put this in the show notes.
Yeah,
but basically, that's kind of weird. That kind of stuff amps up as you play the game, and the sensors range in price from $75 as something that you can strap to your chest that monitors your heart to a $1,400 camera that the game supports that monitors your facial expressions and how you're doing, basically. It just looks like a really interesting game. I'd love to see more people playing the updated versions of it.
I wouldn't mind giving this a try. I don't know if I'd buy it for myself, but I'd like to sit down with a sensor on and see if how calm I can stay. I really want to see a Buddhist monk play this, and then I want to see someone who like has an anxiety disorder play it. Just to see the two sides of the same coin.
You know, no offense, but creepers in Minecraft make you scream like a little girl. So I don't know.
That was also 5 years ago, so we'll see how much I've grown up since then. Who knows? Maybe I haven't.
Well, I mean, the biggest issue with the game is the fact that you need these sensors to monitor you, and that starts at around $75 for this little thing that straps onto your chest. So it's not just picking up the game and playing it. You won't get much out of the game without the sensors. So you need to invest into playing this game that isn't really on the level of something like Outlast, or what was the other example they gave?
I don't know.
Amnesia.
Yeah, I didn't read the article.
It's not really on the level of Amnesia scary, but I guess, you know, it kind of, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
It's not like a what they call a hard-driving horror game?
Right, but it might be something that inspires future games that come out.
Oh, like a stopgap kind of game?
Right.
Like this is what's possible?
Right, like this is a proof of concept. This, you can do this with a game. Now imagine Amnesia with this, where... where that monster picks up its pace and chases you even faster, the more your heart is racing.
I think the idea of integrating biofeedback into games in general has some interesting ramifications. I mean, imagine, you know, we're all used to playing first-person shooters where you can pretty much just run forever like an Iron Man. But imagine if you had a heart rate sensor on while you played Borderlands or Battlefield or, you know, insert FPS here, you know, and you actually had a fatigue meter, and the longer you stayed at a higher heart rate in real life as you were playing, the faster your fatigue meter went down. And when your fatigue goes down, like, you move slower, your reaction times are slower, your aim is shaky, you know, you've got to calm down IRL so you can calm down in game and get the job done. I think that's interesting.
I was thinking kind of the opposite. As your heart rate picks up, that's when you could activate the bullet time kind of things, where your senses are heightened. So, you know, it slows down the game and you get a few extra shots as your heart rate picks up or something.
Right.
That's an interesting approach. I hadn't thought of that.
Getting a little Matrix-y on us there.
Yeah. Creepy.
My story of the week is... well, actually happened last night. Nintendo held one of their Nintendo Direct conferences live from Japan last night around 6 o'clock Eastern, 3 o'clock Pacific for April 2015. And they made a few interesting announcements, you know, no huge big splash that's going to make everybody run out and buy a Wii U, but some interesting game announcements. There's a new Fire Emblem game coming out for Nintendo 3DS. That's going to feature a, the last game, Fire Emblem Awakening, was the first one that allowed you to create your own character rather than playing with a roster of characters that was provided for you. Only in the last game, the custom character that you made in your own image was kind of like a sidekick to the main protagonist. This time around, you will be the main protagonist, and you will need to choose sides between both nations and families to determine your destiny and the overall game storyline. If you're a big fan of turn-based strategy games and you have a 3DS, you might want to look into this when it releases sometime in 2016. There's also going to be a crossover game between Fire Emblem and the Shin Megami Tensei series from Atlus. All they really showed during the Nintendo Direct event was this really confusing but beautiful cinematic. There was no gameplay, though. The art style looks like a kind of a cross between a Persona game and Fire Emblem, and I guess we'll just have to wait and see what's going on with that. In other news from Nintendo Direct, they're releasing a free DLC for Mario Kart 8 on the Wii U. They're going to introduce for the first time in the Mario Kart 8 series a 200cc racing class. This will be the fastest racing class ever since the introduction of Mario Kart as a franchise over 20 years ago. They also announced a couple of Super Smash Bros. Fighters being added to the game. They're adding Mewtwo from Pokemon, Lucas from Earthbound, and they're having a poll from now until October where fans can vote on future fighters to be added later. Also, possibly of interest to you here, Joe, they're going to be making an Attack on Titan game for the 3DS.
Really?
That's what they say. We'll go ahead and put a link to all of that in the show notes. And you can find our show notes at hammergaming.com/hammercast/9 for episode 9. But that's pretty much it for my story of the week. Todd, what's yours?
pardon me. As people may or may not know, Minecraft hosts a yearly convention. And it's in July. It's usually in July. It's different parts of the world. It's been in Florida. It's been in Switzerland, I think. And it's in the UK this year anyways. And a lot of the questions that people have kind of been talking about is since the $2.5 billion Microsoft acquisition of Mojang, is how will Minecon be affected? And so far, Microsoft has really, really, really surprisingly kept their hands out of Minecraft. And they've really let Mojang kind of do their own thing. I'm floored, actually, that they're really giving them the autonomy to do this. And from what it sounds like, they're not touching Minecon at all. They're letting Mojang run it. So Microsoft people are going to be there to observe and just kind of soak in the community and try to, you know, better understand what people are doing with Minecraft and all this kind of stuff. You know, I mean, I'm sure they're trying to figure out how to position Minecraft in the future and how to monetize it and make back their $2.5 billion. What do you guys think about this whole Microsoft leaving Mojang alone sort of thing? I mean, it surprises me. I'm completely floored. I thought Microsoft was going to walk in, you know, shut down all the YouTubers and lock this thing down harder than I don't know what.
Fort Knox.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything in Fort Knox anymore? Is that even relevant?
Who knows?
Anyways, yeah, who knows?
As far as Microsoft and Minecraft, I'm surprised, but I also think that it's probably the right move for them to not jump straight into the Minecon event and everything and change too much, because people already sound weary of what Microsoft is going to do to Minecraft. So them kind of holding back and letting Mojang do what they've always done as far as Minecon is probably the best move for them. And I'm kind of glad that they are.
Yeah, I think the bigger surprise is that Microsoft didn't shut down all the streamers.
Yeah.
You know, because they have every right to do that, and they haven't. I mean, we used to do a Minecraft series that you can find from Dazik's YouTube channel. It was at Dazik LP, I believe, on YouTube.
We'll go ahead and link it in the show notes.
Yeah, and, you know, we were having fun, and it was going fine, and then this whole Microsoft thing dropped and kind of took the wind out of our sails, because everyone was, you know, running around like a chicken with their head cut off saying that Microsoft was going to, you know, cut off all the streamers and all this kind of stuff. Everybody was worried. So we kind of put that on hold for a while, and now, you know, we couldn't really go back to it because we lost the map. But, you know, I mean, there's a chance we could do something in the future. And we have been looking at games and trying to decide what to do a Let's Play of. If anyone has any ideas, be happy to send them to us, because, you know, we'll consider anything at this point.
Yeah.
Not that we're desperate or nothing.
I was about to say, dude, that's how you end up making you LP ET or something.
Well, I don't have ET, although there's probably an emulator.
I was about to say, emulators are easy to find.
And we get override ability on any decision. So it's got to be a good game. It's got to be a fun game. And it's got to be something multiplayer, you know, so... we'll come up with something. Someone comes up with something, you know, we'll do it. We were thinking of doing our Borderlands playthrough, but we were already halfway through the game, so it didn't seem to make sense to start streaming it and recording it halfway through. Plus, we're usually just getting shot at and dying repeatedly anyways and swearing. I mean, I guess maybe that sells.
There's an audience for that.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure there is.
So as far as Minecraft and Microsoft banning the YouTubers from playing it, I'm hoping that they don't do... Well, they haven't, so it's looking good, but Nintendo's been being notorious for copyright claiming people's YouTube videos and stealing the monetization for it and stuff. So Nintendo's been the bad guy in that field lately.
Yeah.
So any game that's a Nintendo game, they're just kind of saying, nope, ours?
Yes.
They're basically saying, we have a right to a portion of your earnings, and we will claim them.
Somebody did a video just showing off an amiibo. They weren't even playing the game with it at the time, and they copyright claimed it because their amiibos were in the video.
Yeah.
And the hell's an amiibo? Is that a Pokemon?
It's basically Nintendo's version of Skylanders.
Yep.
Oh.
It's a little figurine that you can put either on your Wii U gamepad or on your new 3DS, and you place it on the little screen there, and it will sync up and let you do things in certain games.
I thought Skylanders was actually kind of a cute idea, you know, kind of add a collectible concept to a video game. I thought that was pretty good.
Right. Yeah, my kid was huge into Skylanders, actually, thanks to you, Todd. And, you know, it was a really cool series. It was a joy to watch him play it, but it just kind of ended up fizzling out. It lost steam because every time they'd come out with a new version of the game, it wasn't really that compelling. It was just a very thinly veiled attempt to get you to buy more hardware because that's where the money is. And after a while, it's just like, yeah, no, we're done.
Yeah, I know of two people that are into that game for thousands and thousands of dollars.
How?
They just keep, that's how many figurines they've released. Yeah, there's been tons of them.
Wow.
And I'll bet you one of them, if not two of them, you know, if Nintendo's going to come out with their own version, they're going to start spending the money on that too.
Oh, yeah. People are already spending ridiculous amounts of money on eBay for amiibos. And then, of course, Disney's got their own thing with Disney Infinity. Now, the way amiibos, you ask if it's fun, the way amiibos are different from Disney Infinity and Skylanders is that Skylanders is all based around one series of games that these figurines are good for. Disney Infinity is based around a series of games that these figurines are good for. Amiibos are more general purpose. It's up to the developer of an individual game whether they want to be able to make use of amiibos. So right now you can go ahead and use amiibos to store your character data for Super Smash Brothers so that you can go ahead and take your saved progress from the 3DS version and take it over to your buddy's Wii U, drop your amiibo onto their gamepad, and bam, there's your stuff. But there's other games you can use the amiibos with as well.
It's interesting that Disney Infinity, I mean, Disney also owns Marvel, so...
Yeah, and there's tons of Marvel Infinity figurines, too. They just came out last year, I think.
The way that I've seen amiibos being used is you plug it, you hook it up to your Wii U or whatever with the Wii U pad, and it kind of puts a CPU character in, and you can level up your amiibo in the game, and it learns based on how you fight it or how other people fight it. It levels up to 50, and the idea is to kind of mold this CPU to the best of your ability, and then make other amiibos fight each other and see who's trained there's the best and everything. And that's how I've seen them being used.
Really? So it's like a Pokemon sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of neat. I mean,
yeah. What's the game? Oh my God. What's the Disney adventure game that they make that's super popular? Like a Final Fantasy type of game.
Kingdom Hearts.
Kingdom Hearts.
That's the Disney and Square collab.
Right. Gets amazing reviews. And I've watched my brother play. I don't know if it was the first or second one. And it looked like a lot of fun. This actually looks interesting to me. I mean, I don't know that I'd get into it, but it's compelling. It's kind of neat. I've been, you know, I kind of felt that I was too far behind the Skylanders thing. But maybe, I don't know, maybe this is a thing.
Well,
does anyone else out there play Disney Infinity?
And if you do, let us know.
Maybe I'm just a Disney sucker. I don't know. I do like Disney.
Going back to Minecraft, because that's where this kind of all got started. I definitely agree with Joe here. I think that this is Microsoft trying to, you know, saunter into camp without spooking the horses. You know, they know that without the community, they will have wasted what they paid for Minecraft. So they have to do their level best to try and keep the community happy, keep them excited, keep them relatively calm about this new big 800-pound gorilla that's just sauntered into camp. And the best way to do that is to just be chill.
Yeah, but being chill is not Microsoft's way. I mean, that's just not what they do.
Well, I think it definitely says something that a certain person is no longer sitting in the big chair at Microsoft. Ballmer. Under Ballmer's Microsoft, oh, you can bet your bottom dollar this would have been a complete snafu, and they would have, you know, shut down the YouTubers, and Minecon would have become a four colors all the time convention. And, you know, we'd have Steve Ballmer there with sweaty armpits going, developers, developers, developers. But
I mean, aren't the YouTubers half of MineCon? I mean, that's half of the attendees right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a lot of them. Yeah.
But I think the new leadership at Microsoft understands and is capable of understanding what it is they bought in a much more deeper and more meaningful way than old guard Microsoft, as typified by Steve Ballmer.
Yeah, the one that still kind of puzzles me is the modders. You know, I'm waiting for them to figure out a way to start monetizing either these, you know, taking these people's work and monetizing it, or shutting them down or charging them or something. Something's going to happen there.
Right.
Like take their mod, turning it into DLC and then charging for it or something.
Yeah. You know, I've contended forever that I would like mods, like a server would pay for mods. The clients don't have to pay for mods, but the server owners do. And I think it would help differentiate servers between each other.
You wouldn't see those huge mod packs anymore, though.
You might. It would just be a really well-supported server.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you'd want to play. So those people would... that made the server owners that made the investment in their server and bought all those mods, you know, they get better support from the community. And, you know, I'm okay with that. Right now, it's kind of a feeding frenzy out there, and you never know whether or not you're getting a good server or a bad server. You know, ours has actually picked up a lot lately. We've got a lot of new people. We've got some new admins. People are doing some advertising. I keep paying the bills, and, you know, it's doing well. So, you know, I'm just going to kind of let it do its thing. I don't even get to play that often anymore.
Todd, where can people find out about our Minecraft server?
I don't know, Dwayne. Why don't you tell them? Because I don't remember.
Well, if you go over to hammergaming.com/Minecraft, you can learn about our modded Minecraft server, paid for and hosted by the Hammer Gaming community, or, well, Todd anyway, and you can check us out. Like you said, it's picking up in activity now, and lots of friendly people and lots of cool stuff being built every day.
We have a long-lasting community in our Minecraft server. We call them seasons when we do wipes. So every time there's a wipe, we increment a season. Wipes happen a couple times a year, and we are currently on our 9th season. So, you know, we have had our servers running for a very long time now. And we have great admins, and it's very, very chill, relaxed atmosphere. We're currently running the FTB Infinity Pack from Feed the Beast. And if you want more information, go to the link that Dwayne just said.
We'll go ahead and put it in the show notes. I think this is a good time for us to start in on our focus target for the week. We've decided to talk about games that defined their genre. This doesn't necessarily need to be the game that started the genre, but it should be a game that has so thoroughly influenced every other game in the genre ever since that it's basically the common ancestor to every modern game in that genre. So we've picked 5 genres, and we're going to go around the table for each one, and we're going to talk a little bit about which games we feel defined those genres. The first genre this week is the RPG and adventure genre. This has been around since the beginning of time when mastodons roamed the earth. And Joe, what do you think defined RPG and adventure games?
Well, when I was a kid, I first started playing Zelda, the original Zelda. And
Interject real quick, Joe. I actually beat the original Zelda.
Holy shit.
Oh, wow.
You can go on. Sorry.
I did not finish the game, but I watched one of my friends playing it and beating it because he played it a lot and he beat it a few times just for fun. And, well, I mean, a game should be fun, so.
Now, when you say you watched him beat it, you were in the same room. This wasn't over some sort of medieval streaming apparatus, right?
No, I just went
way
over
before
to,
that.
I walked down to his house and watched him play okay. the game.
I want to see you stream over your 36K modem.
Yeah, I was thinking cans and string personally, but go on, Joe. I'm sorry for interrupting.
But basically, this was one of the first games that I saw as an RPG, where you explore kind of a big world and, you know, try to finish this epic storyline as much as Zelda had. And, you know, it starts off with you go into a cave, pick up your legendary weapon, you adventure, you pick up more items. You don't necessarily level up in this game. That wasn't quite the function. You just got more hearts. You picked up more items like bombs and your boomerang and better swords, and you finished an epic storyline. And that's kind of what I feel other games took from it. They looked at this adventure and kind of built on that. I feel like Zelda was one of the original open world RPG games. I don't really have a ton to say about it, so that's all I've got.
Well, I think anyone who's listening to us has played Zelda. If not, then they should turn off the podcast.
Well, if you haven't played Zelda, kids, ask your parents.
Right. Oh, that made me feel old. Thanks. Thanks for that.
You're welcome. So how about you, Todd? What do you think is the game that defined the RPG and adventure genre?
Joe was playing Zelda. I was probably go back a little farther. Maybe not. It's hard to say because I wasn't a big, we had consoles kids, but parents wouldn't buy us a lot of games. Anyways, I would say it would probably be Bard's Tale or King's Quest.
Ah, the King's Quest games.
Yeah. Do those count? I mean, I remember playing King's Quest on my Apple IIe, you know, put in discs, disc 6, side 2, and wait for that to load, and then your little dude was walking, and Yeah, I think those were probably the first adventure games that I ever came across. And I think that, well, I mean, I don't know. They're the first. I don't know that they're necessarily defining. I mean, I guess they're defining because they're the first. But, I mean, there's certainly been better games out there since. But I think those were the ones that I always think of as the old grandpappies of the genre.
All right.
What about you, Dwayne?
Well, I'm probably going to be very predictable about this, but I am going to go all the way back to 1987 to the game that saved their company, Square's Final Fantasy for the NES. This was the first game that I ever played. I mean, I love Zelda, Joe, you know I do, but Final Fantasy was the first game I ever played where you weren't just one hero taking on the forces of evil to save the world. You had a posse. Granted, it was a very pixelated and, you know, low color posse, but you had a posse that you equipped and developed and customized. And that was the first game I ever played where I'd actually encountered that kind of, you know, player and player character development. You know, if it wasn't for my time playing Final Fantasy games, I probably never would have stumbled into things like D&D and what have you. But I believe that this was a genre-defining game because even today, even with games like Dungeons of Dreadmore and Bravely Default, you know, these games are still being informed by conventions that were created in Final Fantasy way the hell back in 1987. And I think this is the mitochondrial Eve of RPGs, at least video game RPGs.
I'd like to point out that I beat both the first Final Fantasy and the first Dragon Quest.
So you used to beat games.
I used to beat games. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And I used to play more console games. I'm not sure why consoles don't do it for me anymore. Maybe it's my eyes aren't as good as they used to be when I was a kid.
Possibly.
I just used to sit 3 feet from the TV. I'm not sure.
Well, you could just pull up a chair and sit 3 feet from the TV and try again.
My eyes were never good as a kid. So
you were always sitting up close to the TV.
What's that you said, Joe? I can't see you. Oh, sorry.
I always got yelled at if I sat too close. So I tried to, but I got yelled at.
We always used to lay on the floor in front of the TV. I always remember me and my brothers.
So the next genre is flight sims. Now, these can be combat or no combat. So anything where you jump into a vehicle and you fly around and you have full control of the vehicle and you're not on rails counts here. So, Todd, what would be your genre-defining flight sim?
Well, I mean, I'm not a big flight sim fan, and I'm going to split it into two. So you have traditional flight sims. So then, I mean, obviously, Microsoft Flight Sim, I mean, they're the standard, right? That's the bar. And then I remember as a kid, for some reason, we played an awful lot of Chuck Yeager's Flight Sim. It was terrible game. It was so boring. So I wasn't a big flight sim fan, because that was all we had as kids. And then that kind of ruined me on the whole genre. Although now you can like almost build yourself full cockpits and all sorts of stuff with all these, you know, multi-function displays and everything,
yep.
Which is kind of cool. You know, because I like buttons and wires and switches and shit. But I think when it comes to, you know, flight sims, I think that, you know, with the resurgence of space sims, we really have to go back to like the Wing Commander series. And, you know, that was the first one that gave us a free flight sim with a story and quests and everything else behind it. And, you know, I remember spending a ton of time at my friend Matt's house as a kid growing up playing Wing Commander on his 386. We even went out and bought a math coprocessor for his 386 just so that it would play the game better.
Did you get the speech from the guy at Radio Shack when you bought the 387?
No, we actually bought the math coprocessor at a computer show.
Oh, okay. I too bought a 387 for my 386, and I did so at Radio Shack back when, you know, Radio Shack sold more than cell phones. And the guy there basically he read me the riot act on making sure I did not shock the crap out of this very expensive little chip.
Yeah, well, I think that was back when everyone was terrified of ESD. You know, I'm going to be honest with you. We're going to break off into this little side topic for a second. I haven't worn an ESD strap in 15 years, and this is what I do for a living.
It's true.
I have only broke one piece of hardware in my entire life due to ESD, and it was 10 years ago.
Wow.
Yep. I was in my socks. I trudged across a carpet. There was a motherboard sitting, we were building a computer, motherboard sitting on the coffee table, and I reached over and zapped the shit out of it. And I'm like, oh, that's over. And we put it together. Yeah, it didn't work.
Yeah.
My finger touched one of the power regulators next to the CPU, and I'm like, yeah, I blew that shit up.
All right. So, Joe, what's your genre defining flight sim?
So I didn't really play a whole lot of flight sims. I played the Microsoft Flight Sim, you know, when I was growing up. I saw it on sale at Walmart or something and bought it. I had actually interesting story. When I bought it, there was this guy just standing over my shoulder watching me look at the game and then gave me a lecture about why it's the greatest thing in the world. I just kind of
creepy guys are creepy.
You know, I'm like 12 years old, and this guy's giving me this talk about how awesome it is, and I'm just like, great. I'm just
something about his joystick, yada, yada, yada. Oh. Yeah.
I was more hoping that I could just, you know, fly into the ground and blow up the airplanes. But other than that, the only other things that I've really played growing up that had flying in it was, you know, in the old Grand Theft Autos, they had some planes that were notoriously hard to fly. So I mastered the Dodo flight in Grand Theft Auto 3, but that was about it.
Dodo flight?
Yeah, in Grand Theft Auto 3, they had this plane called the Dodo that was notoriously difficult to fly. And, you know, if you look it up, people say it's impossible to fly, but I managed to take it on tours around the entire city because I was crazy like that.
Wow. I never heard of the Dodo.
I've heard of the Dodo, but I never actually flew it. The flight model or the flight sim models in GTA games were always so, well, at least in GTA 3, it was so bad that yeah. I couldn't hack it. I was like, you know what? I'm used to things that actually fly like planes. So forget this. I'm going to go back to driving cars and crashing them.
Yeah, I haven't played a Grand Theft Auto game in a while, even though they look like so much fun.
Yeah. I might pick up GTA 5 for the PC when it comes out next week. We'll see.
Is it next week?
It is next week. It is the
14th. $60 for it, though, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, not next week, the week after. It's the 14th.
Yeah, we'll see. Is there any multiplayer in it?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the big part of the game is multiplayer.
Well, then maybe like multiplayer adventure, like you can go through the quests together.
No, you can't go through the quest together, but there's a whole different kind of story around quests and everything. You get phone calls from people that give you quests, and they just introduce heists and stuff.
It's like parallel progression to the single player story.
Right. Hmm.
Interesting.
And speaking of the GTA games, I still need to talk about my genre defining flight sim. I'm just going to go ahead and jump in with the rest of you guys and say it's Microsoft Flight Simulator, because that's what I started on. You know, I just recently, like 2 weeks ago, got back from Florida and I was at my grandmother's house and I got to hang out and show my son the room where I learned to fly. And it was my grandfather's computer room where ages ago on a Tandy 8088, I want to say, in the late 80s, where I first encountered Microsoft Flight Simulator version 4. It looked terrible by today's standards. It was basically a screen full of gauges and you could barely see out of the plane. But I had that, and I had this tiny little four-way joystick that barely lives up to the name joystick. And that was my first experience flying things, and that's where I fell in love with flying things. And every single flight sim, be it, you know, Wing Commander and X-Wing V TIE Fighter and everything, X-Plane has drawn from the stuff that BAO and Microsoft did together in Microsoft Flight Simulator. And that's pretty much the great grandpappy, in my view. But since we're talking about GTA so much, why don't we just skip straight over into the open world and sandbox genre? I'm just going to go ahead and come right out and say it. The defining open world sandbox game is Grand Theft Auto 3. You know, it was the one that showed what an open world sandbox could really be, more than just, you know, top down racing around and finding procedural things to do. This was crafted. It had a story. It had a damn good story. And there was always something new to do or to find around the next corner. How about you, Joe?
Exactly what you said. The Grand Theft Auto series, it started off 2D top down. It was open world, but it was very limited. It wasn't until Grand Theft Auto 3 that they showed really what you could do with the game. I remember picking it up for the PlayStation 2, I believe it was. Was it PlayStation 2? Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember it being so finicky that if the disc had any smudges on it whatsoever, the game wouldn't run. But I guess that was the days of, you know, beginning of discs. And I just remember having a lot of fun just exploring the city. I don't think I've ever officially finished a Grand Theft Auto game, because as soon as I've opened up the entire map, I just start screwing around with the open world. And I noticed in Grand Theft Auto 5, they didn't have you do quests to open up the entire world. So maybe they kind of looked at how people's progression through the story kind of slowed down once they finally unlocked everything. And in a way, that kind of made me get a little bit further in the story of Grand Theft Auto 5, because I had already unlocked everything. So, you know, there was no milestone of exploration in the game. You just have the entire map, and now here's your story. And Grand Theft Auto has just done such a wonderful job with just taking this city and letting you play around in it as you see fit.
How about you, Todd?
So I went kind of a different direction when I saw it come up as the list of being sandbox. I wasn't thinking about little dudes running around. So my brain kind of went a different place, and I thought about Populous by Peter Molyneux as being a procedurally driven, get to play God and kind of run around and do what you want, blow up your dudes or cause storms or change the earth or, you know, whatever you want to do. So that was kind of what I was thinking as more of a sandbox sort of game. But I see where you guys are coming from. I mean, I guess they're all just kind of, well, GTA has obviously GTA 5 now. But nowadays when I think sandbox, I mean, it's just, it's Minecraft, right? I mean, that's the biggest sandbox there is right now.
Yeah.
I was kind of avoiding the obvious one, I think.
Right. But I think that, you know, it's worth mentioning at least that, you know, that's a thing.
I mean, in Minecraft, you can literally have a sandbox, like huge ones, deserts full.
Yeah.
Build a giant sandcastle. I did that once, and then a creeper blew up inside it, and my entire house crumbled.
Oh. Yeah, that's the problem with building out of sand, is it's the softest material. So creepers blowing up really do a lot of damage.
Was this before there was such a thing as sandstone, Joe?
No, I think there was sandstone, but I just used it to hold up like the second floor. So when the creeper blew up, it knocked out the sandstone and chunks of my walls. So everything just kind of sunk down.
Yeah, he was getting ass raped in the middle of that dead desert. I was just across the way outside the desert, and you could just watch his house crumble. From a distance, there'll be chunks missing every now and then.
Oh, that
ever build in a desert on a modded server?
I now have a sad.
No, you should have a funny, because it was.
Okay, well, let's wrap back around and try the 4X and turn-based strategy genre. What are your defining games here, Joe?
I'm going to go way, way back to one of the first games that I ever even played called Ascendancy. It was a space 4X turn-based strategy game where you start off in your little part of the universe. You colonize planets, build spaceships, all based on turns. There was a tech tree that you go down that took so many turns in order to research the things that you would need to upgrade your spaceships, make terraforming easier on different planets. And eventually, after a while, you would start running into the other species that are also inhabiting your piece of the universe. And it was the first game that I ever saw that took turns, and it took so many turns in order to finish different projects, and the fighting was all, you know, you start on this turn, you issue the attacks, it finishes the turn, resolves the stuff that happened there, and then you went on from there. It took so many turns to build a building on a planet, or it took so many turns to construct a spaceship, and it took more turns depending on how complex the building or the spaceship that you wanted to craft, or how advanced the research that you wanted to learn was. And it was the first game that I ever played of that. If you look back at other people talking about the game, they also say that it was one of, you don't really hear about it so much, but I really feel like it was groundbreaking for its time. And that's my game that I chose as turn-based. And I really think it revolutionized, even though it might be more behind the scenes, I feel like it had a big impact on some of the games to come out after that.
Okay. I'm kind of sad to find out. I went and looked up Ascendancy because I've never played it, and the Wikipedia article says that there's an iOS version of it, and I went to iTunes to go look for it, and it's no longer listed on the store. I was going to try it out because you mentioned it, Joe, and, well, it's not there.
It's gone? Really?
That sucks. Yeah. I paid for it. Damn it.
Well, maybe you could still get it if you've already paid for it.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. I'll have to look. I'll have to say, actually, I don't know if I bought it. Maybe I bought it on my Android, my tablet.
I mean, it's very dated now, so it's not as great as it used to seem. There's definitely been improvements on the whole system since then, but it was great for its time.
Todd, what's your genre-defining 4X? Todd's been replaced with a horse, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure. I'm kind of torn between Masters of Orion and Civilization.
Well, I'll tell you what, I will pick whichever one you don't, because those were my two.
I don't know. When did Masters of Orion, the first one, come out?
The first Masters of Orion? Let's find out.
Because Civilization came out in 91.
And Masters of Orion came out in 93.
So they're in the same realm with each other. I don't
although
know.
Really, Masters of Orion came into its own in 2.
2, right. But, I mean, the first one had the same concept. They just fixed it for 2.
Right.
And made it, you know, a better story and everything. Whereas Civilization really has no story. It's just a thing.
It's the story you make.
Right. Which I think we need to play sometime. Anyways. Okay. I think they're very different. I'm having a hard time choosing because, to me, space games are completely different than not space games. So I'll go with Civilization because it was probably a game I played a lot more and still play a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, I still play Civilization now. I'll throw money at any game that has Civilization in the name by the same people. I just think that the whole concept was like revolutionary at the time. And from them until now, although Civ 2, Civ 3, Civ Net, that was kind of a weird time for Civilization when they first started trying to do multiplayer, and it was just terrible. You know, I think that since then, even through now, you know, you still could start playing and you play one more click, and then all of a sudden it's 3 a.m. and you're like, fuck, I gotta work in the morning, son of a bitch. and then you say, well, fuck it, at this point I might as well just stay up all night and keep clicking. So and I think that game had that draw then, and it has that draw now, and there's been a ton of games based off of the same concept. Like what's one I've been playing recently? It's kind of a copy. Oh my God, I have so many windows open. It is Endless Space.
Endless Space. I love that. That's a great game.
It kicks my ass, though. It's really, really hard.
Yeah, it is.
The monsters on the planet, the barbarians, we'll call them, keep just destroying me. So, I think that is a game that's had significant lasting power. I think it defined the genre in its day, and I think it's still relevant today. So I think it's even more powerful than a lot of the other games that we've discussed.
Yeah, you kind of changed my mind on me. After hearing you in a full-throated defense of Civ, I cannot possibly posit the Master of Orion series as a competitor to that. It's got to be Civ.
Right. I've never spent the time playing... I mean, I liked Masters of Orion, and it's a great game, but I have not lost as much time in my life to Masters of Orion or a space-based 4X game as I have Civilization.
Right. I actually just thought up a really funny t-shirt idea. You know those t-shirts that just say, in Helvetica across the shirt, John and Paul and George and Ringo?
Mm-hmm.
They should just have one for Civ that just says one and more and turn and crap.
yeah. And they're releasing a new game. They have a new game coming out.
Starships?
Soon, yeah, Starships, right?
Starships already came out, and I went ahead and took the plunge and tried it out. And I'm sorry to say, gents, it's kind of a disappointment.
Oh, glad I didn't buy it then.
It's more of a board game kind of thing than an actual Civ game, which makes me sad because they went and put Sid Meier's name on it. And I'm not sure they should have.
Was he actually involved?
I do not know.
Or was that a selling point?
Probably. But, maybe we'll set aside some time in a later episode and I'll go ahead and discuss Starships further. Our last genre this week is the real-time strategy or RTS genre. This is the genre that also gave birth to the, golden boy of video game genres right now, the MOBA. Todd, what do you think is the genre-defining RTS?
Well, I mean, the grandfather was Dune 2, as we've discussed in previous podcasts. And no one believed me. We had to go look it up. And nope, I was right, just like usual. And so, I think that was kind of where the birth of it was, Dune 2, those games. But I think it really came into its own during Total Annihilation / not Supreme Commander, but that's way after. Command and Conquer. I think that the Command and Conquer series kind of gave you a story along with RTS, along with progression, and made a really compelling game that has been copied a trillion times now. The first Command and Conquer was kind of the ancestral following of the Dune series. They had a lot of the same concepts and that kind of thing. And if you actually played through them all, they sort of all link, the stories all kind of meld together into one really long, boring story about war and that kind of shit. But I think once Total Annihilation came around, which was made by the Command and Conquer people, but wasn't necessarily Command and Conquer, that was the first time anyone ever broke off and did their own thing. And that turned out because you could have some mods to it and you could, it had more units than Command and Conquer and there wasn't really too much of a story involved. It was really just about massive maps, massive wars, play for hours and hours and hours and backstab each other and blow each other up. And, that was where a good friend of mine, there's an old thing to get rid of the hiccups. You ask someone what swims in the ocean and they say, they're supposed to say fish. And we were in the middle of a big Total Annihilation game and Walter had the hiccups. And I said, Walter, what swims in the ocean? And he looks at me with this dumb face and he goes, well, amphibious tanks. Because that's a thing in Total Annihilation, and that's what we were playing at the time. And I was like, you fucking dumbass. And back to my game, and then I nuked them 15 minutes later. So, you know, that was a kind of a story that unfortunately no one that would appreciate it actually listens to the podcast, but they would get a real kick out of that. Out of me remembering that. So that was that's mine.
Okay.
Beat that, bitch.
Nope, not even gonna try. How about you, Joe? What's your genre defining RTS?
For me, it was probably Age of Empires. I know that Command & Conquer was already out doing this kind of thing, I believe, before Age of Empires did. But for me, Age of Empires was genre defining rather, because of its customization, I suppose. You could... The map editors in that were... I'm trying to think of an example. Have either of you ever played Age of Empires?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, you have to. I mean, that's kind of one of those required games if you like the genre.
Do you remember those maps where... Have you ever played the custom maps where you would start off on this island and you would just have units that stream in, and as you got more kills, the units that would come out would start leveling up?
That sounds that sounds like a proto MOBA.
Well,
with
I know
like
that,
hero units and stuff.
Right. Later on, StarCraft did the same thing where you would get units that pour in, and as you got kills, your units would upgrade, or you could pick different units. But Age of Empires was the first one that I saw with this customization that you could tell the game, once you got so many kills, these kind of units start coming out. Or once you walk over this spot, then this happens. And there was all sorts of ifs, whens. You know, if a unit is here, then this happens. Or once a unit dies, then this happens.
So you could do a little bit of conditional scripting.
Right. It was very customizable. And for me, the game was all about what you could do with its map creators and the script editors and everything. And
well, I think that was the first game that actually came out with map editors and scripting and all that kind of stuff. I mean, there was ways of doing it in the older games, but it was way lower than what that game had.
Yeah. And for me, that's what made it defining, is because now you see it in a lot of different games. You see it a lot in StarCraft, and that's how actually Dota was born, because it was a mod from Warcraft. I mean, Warcraft 3, was it?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, another game to mention in this category is Empire Earth, which...
Oh, yeah.
For a not sci-fi... originally sci-fi based game, Empire Earth 2 was probably my favorite RTS of all time. And that's saying a lot, because I also really like Supreme Commander, but that's all futuristic based. And Empire Earth, you start way back where you only have bow and arrow and spears and sticks and stones and shit. And then you have to do things in order to progress an epoch through time. And every epoch you get new units, some units upgrade, some units don't. Sometimes there's new units. Sometimes units become obsolete, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I think there's like 12 epochs you go through. And, it's kind of a race with the computer. You have to collect resources. New resources show up on the map as you go through epochs. Yep. It's still out. Even now, every now and then I'll still play it today.
It was kind of depressing when you finally mount your army of Marines and you run up to somebody's base and they all get annihilated by a laser turret.
Yeah, I did that too. Back when I worked for a company called Gray Tag at lunch, I had a couple guys that worked for me, and they knew that I played all these games. So they challenged me to a game of Empire Earth, and it had to take place within a 90-minute lunch. We were all going to take a long lunch and stay a little late that day. So they started, and it was the two of them against me. I had already played tons, so I knew all about the game. They really weren't that experienced. So by the time, and that happened, Joe, I mean, by the time they got to me, like I left them alone the whole time. They would every now and then send a couple guys up and I'd kill them. And, by the time they got to me, they had chariots and horses, and I had laser tanks.
Oh, God.
And I killed each one of them with three laser tanks. I was like, okay, guys, that wasn't even a challenge. You guys need to practice or something. So it's all about, and that was a game, if you know the mechanics, like I knew, they didn't know for a long time how to upgrade your epoch. So they were stuck for like half the game. They couldn't figure it out. So they finally figured it out and started catching up a little bit, but they would never have caught me. Even under perfect circumstances, they couldn't have.
So but I'm gonna be the lame noob here. And
noob.
Yeah. Well, I got into RTSs late. I'm sorry.
StarCraft.
Yep, I'm gonna go to StarCraft. And not because I haven't played the games that came before it, as part of dating my wife, I had to learn Age of Empires because she was a huge Age of Empires fan. And I have fallen in love with the game. I played Age of Empires 2 and 3 and Age of Mythology, and they're all great games. But I think StarCraft was the genre definer simply because it took all of the complex systems that you get in, say, a Total Annihilation or a Empire Earth and streamlined it to the point where you could have bite-sized games. It took a deep and complex and very rewarding genre of games. And I know, Todd, you'd probably say it dumbed it down, but I would say it made it bite-sized. It took it and made it approachable to the masses, which is what led to things like Defense of the Ancients, which led to the creation of a whole new genre of games. And I think it not only defined the future of the RTS genre, but it also spawned a whole new other one. And I can't really say that about any other RTSs. So that's kind of why I'm picking StarCraft. Sorry if that's pedestrian.
It's interesting. you think that had a higher or a greater impact on the genre than Warcraft 3 did with all of its mods and Dota and all that stuff?
That's a good question, because Warcraft did beget StarCraft. It definitely came before and after, because Warcraft 3. Yeah, I'm not entirely certain about that. I would say that Warcraft begat StarCraft Warcraft 3, which begat MOBAs. So you could argue that the first two Warcraft games were a bigger contender to defining the genre than StarCraft ever was. But then at the same time, you don't see anybody playing Warcraft competitively. I mean,
well, not anymore, because Dota has turned into its own thing. But I mean, people definitely play Dota competitively on Warcraft 3.
Well, I'm just talking about, like, if you look at StarCraft and you look at the esports angle of it all, like, completely forget about MOBAs. Let's just focus solely on RTSs. Warcraft was around for a long time before there ever was a StarCraft, but StarCraft did something, and not just here. I mean, they have entire television channels where people watch people play in Korea. And yeah, it's crazy. StarCraft, there's some sort of secret sauce in StarCraft that wasn't quite there in the Warcraft games that came before it. And there was a little bit of it in Warcraft 3, and they added the whole hero unit thing, and the hero unit thing led directly to the birth of MOBAs. But yeah, there's something about StarCraft. I can't quite put my finger on it. If I ever find it, I'll bring it up and follow up on a later show. But I'm going to go ahead and stick to my choice and say that it's StarCraft, because Korea, yo.
But StarCraft didn't have, you could type 11 to hear start the game already, and you couldn't spam sound messages in the game. So... Oh, I'm joking, by the way.
Okay. Well, that wraps up our focus target this week, and we're running a little long, so we're going to jump right into the Colosseum. Each week, we compile a rapid-fire list of the last 7 days' news and submit them to our twin emperors, Joe and Todd, for judgment. First up in the Colosseum this week, we've got the Half-Life 2 update mod. This is a community-made enhancement mod by Philip Victor and published by Valve for free on Steam last week. It basically takes Half-Life 2 and gives it a bit of a graphical massage after 8 years of aging. We'll go ahead and put that mildly. Given the stuff last week about this answer, non-answer from Gabe Newell about a Half-Life 3, it's interesting to see Valve go ahead and help this community modder publish this thing for everyone on Steam. How do we feel about this, Emperor Todd?
So this is the same game, just with upgraded graphics and stuff.
Yes. It's got improved effects, improved textures, et cetera, but it looks the same. Well, the models are the same. It plays the same. It just looks a little better because we've got video cards that can run rings around the original Source Engine at this point and might as well spend those cycles doing something interesting.
Right. I mean, I'm not holding out for Half-Life 3, so anything people do to Half-Life 2, I think is cool. I think if this mod is something that other people can use to make more content for Half-Life 2, then maybe it breathes some more life into it and we can go on with life. I mean, the best thing that came out of Half-Life 2 was Gmod, and that kind of turned into its own monster all by itself. And people have created some amazing things in that. Right. So, I guess thumbs up.
How about you, Emperor Joe?
Thumbs up. It looks very pretty. I saw some of the little video comparison things. The lighting is a lot better. They modified some of the terrain to look nicer. So, thumbs up. It looks good.
Okay. Next up, we have Asteroids Output. This is You did?
I did.
This is a Steam Early Access game that reimagines the Atari classic shoot 'em up as a multiplayer sandbox survival game. The only thing it seems to have in common with the original game is the asteroids. It's set on one, and you'll have to build turrets to defend yourself from smaller space rocks falling on you and your creations. This smacks of kind of Minecraft in space, but with a nostalgic brand name. How do we feel about this, Emperor Joe?
It reminded me a lot of space. What was that space game? I can't remember.
There have been several space games.
Space Minecraft-y kind of game where you can pilot your spaceship. And
Space Engineers?
Space Engineers. It kind of reminds me of that if Space Engineers focus solely on defending yourself from the asteroids that do hit inside Space Engineers. It looks interesting. I haven't seen a whole lot about it, just that little trailer clip that they had of it. I'll have to look more into that. I'll have to watch Todd play it.
How about you, Emperor Todd? Have you had a chance to play?
I have not. It was on sale before I left for my trip. It was half off, so I picked it up. We'll see. I mean, Minecraft in space makes me a little tight in the pants, so... Space Engineers didn't seem like it was progressing as fast as I would have liked. The modders didn't really pick it up as much as I would have liked. I think it has a ton of potential, but until, it's like vanilla Minecraft kind of sucks. It's the modders that make the game fun to me. So until that same community is built for Space Engineers, that game is going to be just as boring. We'll see. If this is Minecraft in space, great. If not, whatever, maybe. So I only paid, I don't know, $18 or $20 for it. So I only have to play it for 2 hours in order to get my money's worth. I always compare everything to going to the movies. So I need 4 hours. It would be 2 movies. So hopefully I can get 4 hours of play out of it.
Wait, it's interesting that the movie tickets are $10 out by you?
Actually, Phil can get them for $8, I think, through work.
I hate you.
Yeah, and they're much nicer theaters than you guys have out there. So you can just suck it. Wow. Totes. Wow. Totes 250. So, they did make a comment in one of the things I was reading about this, about other things. They made, I'm trying to think of how they worded it, but they talked about other concepts within the asteroids universe. I'm like, oh, okay.
What asteroids universe?
Right. I don't know. Apparently they're trying to build this whole concept, this whole.
That's like Hasbro saying that there's somehow a battleship universe now that they've had a movie based on the board game.
Could be, right? They could do it. So we'll see. I don't know if there's more stuff in the pipe or what the deal is, but maybe there's more asteroids out there.
Wow.
So I'll give it a thumbs up.
All right. And just to go ahead and kick some sand in your face here at the beach, Emperor Todd, we're going to shuffle around the Coliseum here because you said vanilla Minecraft sucks. Using nothing but slime, pistons, TNT, and no mods, Minecraft player Cube Hamster Innovation has created a walking attack robot with, quote, sequential missile launcher and double mini nuke cannons. According to PC Gamer, it's essentially Metal Gear, but in block form. On YouTube, there's a video of this monstrosity marching up to a desert village and obliterating it with its payload. How do we feel about this, Emperor Todd?
I've obliterated some things with my payload. Anyways,
wow. I couldn't resist.
Oh, okay.
I can't give you any openings, can I?
No, that was such a good one, though. I mean, you know, thumbs up to the dude for building this thing. I'm surprised someone hasn't done it already. I mean, people have built all sorts of crazy things in vanilla Minecraft, and I'm not saying that vanilla Minecraft isn't good for what it is. I'm just saying it's boring to me, you know, because you could take mods and build that whole thing 10 times easier and accomplish the same thing. Now, great. It's mental masturbation that he went about and did that and then blew his load on a village. So, I mean, that's awesome, but it's just not my idea of fun in Minecraft. So thumbs up.
How about you, Emperor Joe?
I'll give it a thumbs up because it must have taken a lot of work to get that working the way it did. But like Todd said, it's not really something that I would have fun doing when, like he said, with mods, you could just build it 10 times quicker, probably look a little better. And your destruction factor, you could put nukes into it instead of just regular TNT. So,
right, actual nukes.
So, yeah, it's cool that he did it. I mean, it kind of shuffles around the world. It only works if the world is flat, because if you were to walk over a canyon, it would just kind of float over it at that point. But right.
Yeah, I don't think he can steer it. Cool. And he's riding in it on a boat. Just saying.
Yeah.
So thumbs up or thumbs down, Emperor
Joe?
Thumbs
up. It was cool.
All right. Hundreds of Steam keys for Alchemy Labs' new game Discourse have been hidden across the United States, and they've made an alternate reality game website to help diligent fans find them. The game is currently available on Steam for $15 after a successful Kickstarter campaign, and it's a choose-your-own-adventure with a very unique art style and, so far, decent reviews. One of the caches of keys has already been located. It's on Cards Against Humanity's Hawaii 2 Island up in Maine, that they purchased as part of their holiday festivities, for which there was another
part of that island. Damn it.
Yeah, so do I. It was part of their ARG that they did with their 12 days of whatevermas. And there is supposedly a USB key hidden somewhere on that island with 100 keys for this game. No one's actually gone and picked it up yet, though. How do we feel about this, Emperor Joe?
I don't know how I feel about it. It's just kind of, I've never really heard about the game. So the interest in a whole bunch of keys for it seems kind of lacking for me, I suppose.
You don't want to go out there and see if there's anything hidden in the Seattle area?
Nah.
I love scavenger hunts. I think they're awesome.
So how do you feel about this, Emperor Todd?
Well, first of all, I think it's a thumbs up because they only raised $44,000 and actually made a game. Good for them, because, you know, I have this $800,000 number that I always shout, and, you know, I think it's impossible to do anything for less than that. And they took a very small amount of money and made something that people really like. and then made a scavenger hunt, and I like scavenger hunts, so they get thumbs up for me.
Cool. I'm going to assume for the record, Emperor Joe, that you're kind of thumbs limp.
Yeah, indifferent.
All right. Well, next up, we've got Steam's Discovery Update, which rolled out late last year. It's been a great boon for, well, Discovery. Valve announced via Reddit last week that product views are up 30% across the entire Steam service since the update, and has increased revenues for apps that aren't in the top 500 by an average of 5%. The curator feature, however, has not been as popular as they'd like, and they make plans to give tastemakers a more prominent place in the Steam client in future updates. How do we feel about more and smaller games getting more attention and more money, Emperor Todd?
I have to admit that I've bought a few games this way, where it says, hey, you like this, so you should take a look at this, and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, I guess thumbs up, because it made me spend money. You know, because I'm notorious for buying games and never actually playing them. I probably half my Steam library is like that. I'm sure, you know, my husband's listening and he goes, God damn it. But you know, it is what it is. So, you know, I'll give it a thumbs up. It's helped me find some things that I may not have gone digging for otherwise.
How about you, Emperor Joe?
Thumbs up. I've used the thing just to review the games and add a couple things to my wish list. So yeah, I'll give it a thumbs up. It's a cool feature.
Yeah, I'm with Todd here. I have definitely spent a bit more money than usual since the Discovery update has been presenting me with so many games that I otherwise would never have noticed and then snapped up. A fan-made in-browser HD remake of Super Mario 64 was very briefly available last week. It took advantage of the latest in-browser technology, and a fan was able to recreate the 1996 classic and make it playable on a web page. Nintendo, of course, was swift to send the cease and desist to the fan's web host, and sadly, the game is no longer available for play. Current law forces companies like Nintendo to protect their trademarks aggressively, lest they lose their rights over them. But Nintendo in particular, as Joe mentioned earlier in the show, is known for a draconian stance when it comes to fan-created tributes and other work. How do we feel about this, Emperor Joe?
I'll give it a thumbs down, I suppose. I mean, I understand that Nintendo needs to protect their licenses, but I mean, he was just doing like a proof of concept thing. He wasn't trying to monetize it or anything. It was basically a reconstruction of one of the levels in Super Mario 64 in the Source engine, wasn't it?
Something like that. I don't recall the details. I'll dig up the link to the articles on it and we'll put it in the show notes so folks can read about it later.
But yeah, I think it was just a proof of concept kind of thing he was doing, and Nintendo kind of swung the hammer down on him. So I'll give it a thumbs down, because I kind of would have liked to see a Source engine Super Mario 64.
How about you, Emperor Todd?
I blame lawyers for this bullshit. It's like, if it wasn't, you know, if Nintendo didn't have to aggressively defend their trademarks lest you lose them, I mean, it's kind of bullshit. I mean, this guy wasn't trying to make any money off it or anything like that. It was doing absolutely no harm. Microsoft or Nintendo could have just turned around and said, yeah, this is cool. We endorse this, and put their stamp on it and say that, you know, the dude had permission, even if it was posthumously. You know, it would have been fine. So I think, you know, Nintendo, again, you're an asshole, and stop this shit, because it's really making me not like you.
I tend to agree that this is definitely a lawyer-driven thing, both the lawyers who make such laws and the lawyers at the companies who have to watch these companies' asses. You know, you can tell that this is the kind of decision that was made in an office at Nintendo Legal and not by someone like Shigeru Miyamoto, who would be like, oh, cool, look what he did with my stuff. But anyway, moving right along. Microsoft apparently planned to make their original Xbox console a target for casual gamers, and they hoped to give away the hardware for free. In an interview with Games Industry, Lauren Lanning revealed that Microsoft hoped that his Oddworld games would turn into a Mario competitor for kids and casual adult gamers' attention. Microsoft ended up doing a complete 180 on this strategy, instead purchasing Bungie and targeting so-called hardcore gamers since the Xbox launched in 2001. How do we feel about that, Emperor Todd?
Ah, that's typical Microsoft bullshit. Whatever. I guess it would have been neat if it was casual, but it doesn't surprise me that they took something that made them more money, or at least they thought would make them more money. After all, they have stockholders to answer to. So I'll give it a thumbs limp.
How about you, Emperor Joe?
Well, I'll think of the bigger picture and give it a thumbs up. If they didn't turn it into the console that it is now, then there wouldn't be more competition, and we might not see PlayStation at the level it is now if they weren't constantly competing with Xbox.
Well, it's awfully difficult to compete with someone who's giving away their hardware, though.
No, right, but
it could be the only console on the market right now, if that was okay.
Yeah, and that would suck, because there'd be no Nintendo and no Sony competition.
Right. So adding competition makes other consoles better. So in a way, it's good that they turned it into what it is now, so that other consoles and other platforms have to kind of up their game.
The one thing about this I'm really curious about is that, Microsoft ended up taking a bath on the Xbox 360 because of all of the hardware flaws and failures that they suffered and all the replacement plans they had to honor. And it makes me wonder if they would have lost anywhere near as much money had they just given away the original Xbox for free.
Pretty good question.
That would be interesting math to take a look at.
Yeah.
Next up, we've got Anita Sarkeesian, the pop culture critic who has made many video series highlighting the problematic depiction of women in video games. And she's got a new companion series that looks at the positive side of the same coin. Positive Female Characters is her new series, and its first episode focuses on Capybara Studios' Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery EP and its stoic female protagonist, the Scythian. I don't know if you guys ever played this on iOS. It was a great puzzle adventure game. I loved the hell out of it. Sadly, it doesn't have much in the way of replay value, but it was definitely one of the best mobile experiences I have ever had. How do you feel about this, Emperor Joe?
It looks like a cool game. I mean, I've seen other games. I always end up playing Mass Effect as the female protagonist. So it's good to see other games with female leads, even if they are kind of the silent protagonist type.
And how about you, Emperor Todd?
I don't know. I always felt Liara was a pretty positive force in Mass Effect. But yeah, it's good.
Who knows? Maybe there might be an episode about Liara later on in the series.
Maybe.
We'll have to keep watching and find out. The final item on the Colosseum this week is Elite Dangerous. I know Todd and I play, and so do several listeners. The game is now listed on Steam, and Frontier is not yet clear on whether existing owners will be able to transition their licenses to Valve's game service. How do we feel about this, Emperor Todd?
I like all my games in Steam. Fuck Origin. Fuck direct downloads. I just want it all on Steam, so it's all in one place. It's like when I blow up my computer, I can just go back to Steam, select a whole bunch of things, and click install. And then on my Totes 250 connection, it all comes down in the next hour or so.
And how about you, Emperor Joe?
I don't own the game. So, I mean, it's now on Steam, so now you can buy it on Steam. I'll give it a thumbs up if they give you a code to install it on Steam with.
All right. The thing that concerns me about this is that Elite Dangerous has its own launcher and installer. So I fear that what's going to happen is that when it shows up on Steam and you download it, you're just going to be downloading the launcher.
Right, but it's better than me having to go to Frontier's website, log in, dig through there to find the freaking download link, if I ever need to reinstall it. I can just go where all my other games are, right click, install.
Right. Okay, that makes some sense. And I think that will draw us to a close for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, follow us on Twitter. We're at Hammer Gaming. And make sure to use the hashtag Hammercast so we know you're talking about the show. We're also on Facebook, and you can find us at facebook.com/HammercastFM. Have you enjoyed the show? Well, I certainly hope you have if you're still here. Subscribe to us in your podcast player of choice. We're available on the iTunes Music Store, Stitcher, and via direct RSS feed on our website. And you can find links to all of that at hammergaming.com/hammercast. So until next week, we'd like to say take care. Say goodbye, guys.
Goodbye, guys.
Bye, guys.